I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In Kansas and Missouri, the Farm Bill is a big deal, and not just for farmers. In Congress, the Senate and the House have so far each passed their own versions, but now have to find compromises that will turn this year's bill into law. Today, we'll discuss those areas of contention and find out how long lawmakers have to come to an agreement that will affect millions. Then, President Trump's ongoing war with Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller is ringing a few bells for political watchers who remember President Clinton's legal grapplings with former independent counsel Ken Starr. But how well does the comparison stand up? We'll find out on Up to Date after this hour's news. The Farm Bill is always a big deal when it comes before Congress every few years. This year is no different. The House and Senate have each passed their versions of a Farm Bill. Now lawmakers will go to conference committee to work out a mutually agreeable bill. Now an update on the major players and issues on a bill that affects so many Kansans and Missourians, and not just in the rural parts of our states. The Farm Bill also covers food stamps, which impacts many city dwellers. One difference between the two chambers on food stamps: should recipients have to work in order to receive them? With us, Grant Gerlach is a Harvest Public Media reporter at NET News. He joins us by phone from NET Studios in Lincoln, Nebraska. Grant, always good to have you. Welcome back.
Yeah, good to be back with you, Steve.
Give us a short primer, if you would, Grant, on where lawmakers are in the process now of passing this once every five-year farm bill.
Well, they're starting to get to the final stages, and that's a good thing because they're also kind of getting to crunch time here in terms of coming up against a deadline at September 30th when the current Farm Bill would expire. So as you mentioned, there's a House bill that's been passed, a Senate bill that's been passed, and now a conference committee that's planning to get together early next month, to come up with a final version of a bill that hopefully will be able to pass each chamber again and eventually make its way to President Donald Trump's desk.
Is the betting line that lawmakers will, in fact, get this done by the end of September deadline?
I wouldn't put any money on that, Steve. but it's hard to tell. There's a few different things going on, a couple different lines of thinking. One is that President Trump may push them to get something done in good time for the midterms so they can hold it up as a legislative accomplishment. On the other hand, maybe there isn't that much pressure to get it done if they have sort of the versions of the bill that they can go back and tout with constituents when you look at the differences between the House bill and the Senate bill. So, you know, from here outside of the Beltway anyway, it's hard for me to get a good read on just whether they're really positioned to get this done by the end of September or not.
Who's looking out for the heartland here? I mean, which lawmakers from Kansas, Missouri, Iowa, Nebraska are part of this conference committee?
Well, the person from the region who's really at the center of things is Senator Pat Roberts from Kansas. He is the chair of the Senate Ag Committee.
And he's been through a whole bunch of these farm bills over the years, right?
Well, no doubt about it. And so he'll really be in the middle of it when it comes to that conference committee next month. And, in fact, has been talking to the other leaders in the Ag Committees from the Senate and the House here over the last several weeks leading up to that, trying to work through some of the smaller stuff so that when they get together, they can really get to the heart of the matter.
Is there anybody else from the heartland on this conference committee?
Yeah, you know, when I was looking through, there are about a dozen lawmakers from the Midwest, depending on which places you include in the Midwest. But we've got Colin Peterson, a Democrat from Minnesota in the House. He's the ranking member of the House Ag Committee. You've got Senator Joni Ernst, a Republican from Iowa, who's on the conference committee. Vicky Hartzler, Republican from Missouri in the House. Is in the conference committee. Roger Marshall from Kansas, Republican, is also on the conference committee.
We'll turn to some specifics in a few minutes, but just in general, Grant, how much space is there between the Senate and the House versions of this new Farm Bill?
Well, if you look at the bill overall, for a lot of the stuff that especially the farmers are paying close attention to, there aren't necessarily huge differences. For the stuff where there's the biggest distance, the biggest gap, which is in the nutrition programs, the food stamps, the SNAP program, the problem is that those differences are so intractable the way that the politics work that it creates some real problems trying to come up with a final bill. So if you look at things like crop insurance or the commodity programs that pay farmers for low grain prices, the differences in how those programs work from one bill to another aren't that huge and seem like the kind of things that the committee should be able to work out. But again, it gets to the SNAP program. That's sort of the big one.
Yeah, let's turn to the SNAP program, and you're right. That seems to be the one that is getting the most attention here because the SNAP program, this new requirement, would dictate that millions more people have to go to work at least part-time to qualify for benefits going forward. But the Senate so far, as you're pointing out here, is rejecting this idea wholesale. So how do you see this thing playing out?
Well, that's a good question. So as you mentioned, there are... Just so people understand, there are some work rules for people in SNAP. They're referred to as able-bodied adults without dependents. Those are folks who do have to currently work 20 hours a week or show that they're going to training programs or some qualifying programs in order to receive their benefits. The plan in the House is to expand that.
I see.
To basically double it and include people that haven't been included in the past, people with children in school, and some folks that are on the older range of things. So that is basically a non-starter among Senate Democrats. Well, actually, it's a non-starter among House Democrats, too, but in the House, the Republicans don't necessarily need the Democrats mm-hmm. to pass a bill. In the Senate, they do. And so when the Senate Democrats say, we're not going for that, you end up with a situation, a question whether you can pass a bill at all if that's left in there. So what can they do? If they're really committed to having some of those things in there, maybe they back them off and make them pilot programs or studies or things like that. That's sort of a common tactic to save face, if you will.
And move the ball down the field at the same time, right?
Yeah. So it could be something like that, depending on how hard Senate Democrats really want to fight on it.
But this one, there's no question, this is a real sticking point as you look at the lay of the land here.
Absolutely. This is the thing that the Democrats are really planning to dig in on.
Well, the Senate wants to also place income limits on farmers who receive payments through those USDA programs that try to make up for low crop prices. So if I get this right, farmers who make over $700,000 a year would not be eligible for those payments, but the House is rejecting that idea too.
Yeah, and this is something that has been Senator Grassley from Iowa has been pushing for a long time, and currently the limit is $900,000. He wants to lower it, and the Senate has approved the idea of lowering it to $700,000, and the House won't go for that. And so this is something that different groups fight for and see it as sort of a way to fashion a bill that is aimed more at those mid-sized farmers and offers less to wealthier farmers. So we'll see where that ends up. I'm not sure exactly how to read that one, the way that the House is going for it. It could end up just being kind of a bargaining chip in this thing.
There's something else. The Conservation Stewardship Program is another bone of contention. I want to play part of a report you did on this, but before we play that, Grant, tell us briefly what the CSP, as it's called, has farmers doing here. Again, this is the Conservation Stewardship Program.
That's right, and this is a program where farmers can apply to the USDA and receive a contract, usually like a 5-year contract, where they agree to change the way they farm, do something differently. It could be planting cover crops. It could have to do with, you know, limiting erosion or limiting the kind of runoff that can cause water pollution from their farm fields. And in return, they would receive some payment for performing those conservation practices on their farms.
Okay, here's Grant Gerlach talking about the Conservation Stewardship Program.
It's not getting a lot of love from Congress in the next farm bill.
Well, the House is definitely cutting money out.
This is Dan Charles. He covers food and agriculture for NPR, and he's been looking into what the next farm bill means for conservation programs.
I mean, just for context, people should understand that there are billions of dollars in the USDA budget authorized by the farm bill that basically pay farmers to do things that by one measure or another are, you know, sort of benefit the environment. The House bill would basically cut $1 billion out of that account. That's, you know, that's a lot of money.
$1 billion over 10 years cut from conservation. That includes repealing the CSP program. Critics in the House say other programs do more for the money.
What are those other programs the House is referring to here, Grant?
Well, the House idea is to fold the CSP program into another program that has a wonderful acronym. It's EQIP, EQIP. And I'm not going to bother spelling that one out for you, but
right.
the main point is that these are similar in terms of how they work. In the EQIP program, farmers will have a contract to do something, but the big difference between CSP and EQIP is that the CSP is seen as sort of a whole farm program. It's not just one field. It's not just one patch of ground. It's doing something over your whole farm. And EQIP is really focused on, okay, I'll make this field a wetland or something like that, just sort of smaller projects. So a lot of farmers like the bigger idea. If they're going to make an investment in how they farm, changing how they farm, it's something that you do across the whole farm. And so some EQIP projects may not have as large of a wholesale impact in the way someone does their farm operation than the CSP program would.
You know, anybody who's covered ag issues before Congress has got to be up on their acronyms, Grant. I'm always amazed
no doubt.
At exactly how many acronyms there are attached to this kind of spending. Well, the House wants to end CSP, again, the Conservation Stewardship Program. The Senate wants to keep it. Why isn't the Senate on board with reducing these funds for conservation programs?
Well, again, it's a pretty popular program. The CSP has a large enrollment in the number of acres, the number of farmers who are involved, and so there is a constituency for it really out there, and a lot of environmental groups like it too because it sort of meets farmers in the middle. It gets them to do something that has environmental benefits, but it doesn't ask them to stop farming that land, which some other programs do, namely the Conservation Reserve Program takes farmland out of production. To serve as wildlife habitat or to improve the environment. And so it's popular in that way. In EQIP doesn't work exactly the same way in that aspect.
Is anybody not backing down on any of these, you know, just unwilling to compromise?
Well, the House certainly is not backing down at this point from their SNAP changes. Are they willing to compromise, I think, is a different question, and we haven't necessarily maybe gotten to that crunch time where they're going to have to make a decision of whether they're going to go back and say we got a farm bill done, but we had to, you know, back off on some things, or if they're really going to plant their flag on these SNAP work requirements and try to fight for them, even if it means they don't get a farm bill passed on time.
We're talking about the farm bill that's working its way through Congress right now with Grant Gerlach of Harvest Public Media. How have the president's tariffs affected how lawmakers are looking at this farm bill, Grant?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. If you look at the tariffs overall, it certainly sent a chill through the farm economy. You know, the full weight of it hasn't necessarily been felt today. But the sheer volume of soybeans, for instance, that the U.S. sends to China, that exports to China, creates this fear that if that market were to really dry up, there would be some severe ripple effects. And so what does that mean for the farm bill? I think the main thing it adds is some urgency to get it done if they don't pass it by September 30th. Now, if they don't pass it, that doesn't mean that programs like crop insurance and these commodity payments, those wouldn't necessarily just disappear, but farmers are trying to plan for next year, really, at this point. They're just getting ready for harvest, but they're looking ahead, and they want to know what programs they're going to be working with because they'll be making some important decisions about where they put their money for the next growing season.
You know, I can't help but think about the Farm Bill. It's unlike so many pieces of legislation that Congress winds up dealing with because, you know, the bill is in place for not just 1 or 2 years, but 5 years. How does that change things for lawmakers?
Well, it does have that longer timeline for it. Part of what I think is interesting about it is you end up with a little different political lens on it each time around. You know, I've been looking a little bit into the history of that, and for instance, we've been talking about SNAP, the food stamp program, being part of the Farm Bill, and that wasn't always the case. Before 1964, the farm programs were really just part of their own legislative process, and it was part of the Great Society, the War on Poverty, and the Lyndon Johnson administration, where that was brought in as a way to bring urban and rural lawmakers together, and that sort of set a different paradigm, if you will, for the politics of the Farm Bill for years and years and years until we get to sort of these last couple rounds where that doesn't necessarily seem to be doing the trick anymore in terms of getting a Farm Bill passed. And you have these sort of more ideological perspectives on things like food stamps that are coming into play. So that's one thing, you know. It's just every 5 years or so, but over time you see a real difference in the politics of it.
And the politics have always been sort of centered on this idea of bipartisanship, unlike so many other aspects of legislation that Congress works on. Bipartisanship is at the core of the Farm Bill. Why is that tradition sort of maintained itself even through these difficult times?
Well, because it gets it done. And for the different interests in the bill, they've found this sort of comfort zone working with each other where they're willing to give and take to a certain point to get the things they want. So you have, you know, some more urban lawmakers who may be more likely to be Democrats who are willing to offer more to the rural lawmakers who are more likely to be Republicans. And they may not work together very well on a lot of other issues, but they can work together on this one because the trade-offs are there, and they add up. You know, the political calculus works for it. And that's sort of what's been changing. If you look at the House version of the Farm Bill this year, not one vote from a Democrat, either in committee or on the floor. And that's different. That's just a change of how work has been done on the Farm Bill in the past. And if you look at the Senate, it's a bit of a throwback in terms of how it's worked. And there was really broad support for the Farm Bill when it passed in the Senate this year. So you're starting to see this sort of this divide in terms of how the Farm Bill works its way through through Congress that reflects the larger politics that are going on.
You know, you mentioned at the start of our conversation that Congress has until the end of September to finish this bill because that's when the current Farm Bill expires. What's the timeline, Grant, for the conference committee to finish its work in the days and couple weeks to come?
Well, they're planning to get together on September 5th, and I think that will be that'll shed some light on where things stand. The questions are how much work were Pat Roberts and the other leaders from these ag committees, how much work were they able to get done in August to set up this conference committee getting together? Were they able to work through all that small stuff so they can really focus in on SNAP? Were they even able to come to any agreement on SNAP at all? Or are they going to end up getting in the room and finding out that they have more work to do than they can actually finish in the month of September? Because there aren't that many working days for these lawmakers to get things accomplished in September. So, they really are hitting the point where they need to figure out whether they can get it done or whether they need to step back and try to pass just an extension of what already exists.
Just a final point here. Is the president weighing in on this bill at all? And if so, what's he saying? Is he likely to sign whatever Farm Bill is put in front of him, Grant, or how do you see it?
Well, that's also a pretty good puzzle, because the things he's been saying are, number one, we're going to get a Farm Bill passed for these farmers, and number two, that Farm Bill should have work requirements in it, these work requirements we've been talking about. And, of course, the problem is that those two things don't necessarily work together. The reason that it's less likely to pass is because the work requirements are in it.
Yeah, right.
So,
right.
So the question is, will he be satisfied with some watered-down version of the work requirements, or is he really going to sort of team up with the House leadership to push something stronger through, if they could? So it's an interesting question of where does the president really stand on the farm bill? Does he just want something to show up on his desk that he can sign and then tout around the country, or does he really have an interest in what ends up being in the bill in terms of those work requirements?
Which is always the question when it comes to President Trump. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, certainly, yeah.
That's Grant Gerlach with Harvest Public Media. Thanks so much, Grant. Sure, appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome.
You can hear more from Grant Gerlach on his On the Table podcast wherever you find your podcasts. Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about President Trump and President Clinton, their battles against special prosecutors. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, we heard local reactions to a recent report on 7 decades of sexual abuse by Catholic priests in Pennsylvania. It was a tough but important discussion. You can hear it at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, the film critics return to review the latest in independent foreign and documentary films, including Spike Lee's Black Klansman, co-written by University of Kansas film prof Kevin Wilmot. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, President Trump's ongoing war with independent counsel Robert Mueller may ring a few bells with longtime watchers of American politics. President Bill Clinton waged the same type of all-out war to discredit the prosecutor who looked into his affair with Monica Lewinsky. That man was Ken Starr. But now that the pressure on the president has risen dramatically in the wake of Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort's conviction and former Trump personal lawyer Michael Cohen's plea deal, it's a good time to compare the president's ongoing face-off with a special prosecutor to the last president to go toe-to-toe with one, and that's Bill Clinton. With us to talk about this are a pair of political scientists, Max Skidmore from UMKC. Max, welcome back.
Thank you, Steve. Glad to be here.
Burdette Loomis is also joining us from the University of Kansas. Bird, nice to have you.
Great to be here, Steve.
Does this feel like deja vu, Max Skidmore?
Not really. Nobody likes to be investigated, and presidents, like everyone else, don't like to be investigated. And there is a surface similarity, of course. Each president was investigated, and in fact, Clinton wound up getting impeached. But the circumstances are quite different.
What about you, Bird?
Yeah, you know, I'd agree with Max here that once you get into it and pretty far down the line with Clinton and James Carville and leading an attack, there are some similarities. But we're only, 16 months into the Mueller investigation. And at first there was no concentrated attack on him. But over the last 6 months, 7 months, between Trump and Fox News, you really have this concentrated early attempt to discredit. So I think there are some real differences.
You know, how did Byrd special prosecutors get involved with both of these presidents and make their lives all the more hellacious than they already are?
Well, I think you really do need to think in political terms in both instances, but particularly I think with Clinton. Early on, you had the Whitewater investigation. And remember, you had people involved in politics who remembered in great detail the special prosecutor in Watergate. And so there had been a special prosecutor in law written. It had lapsed. And so you ended up with a special prosecutor being appointed under iffy circumstances to investigate this Whitewater land deal, which I think that was a political choice to begin with, and then it went on from there, ending up with Monica Lewinsky and an impeachment.
But there is a difference here, isn't there, Max, because the current special prosecutor is operating under the purview of the executive branch, if I understand this correctly.
Correct. Well, the first prosecutor did as well, Robert Fisk, was appointed before Ken Starr. And Fisk was looking into the Whitewater land deal, which had occurred 20 years previously when Clinton was governor. And there had been a long-time effort in Arkansas, the Clinton Project. Richard Mellon Scaife, billionaire from Pittsburgh, largely funded it, and there were others involved too, mm-hmm. about trying to discredit the Clintons. And so they created enough concern that a special prosecutor was investigated. There was also the suicide of Vince Foster, a friend of the Clintons, Hillary especially. And I don't know, I think Hillary and Bill were both friendly with mm-hmm. Vince Foster, and both were certainly stricken by his suicide. But the investigators were motivated by movement conservatives, as they call themselves, who were convinced, after all, Rush Limbaugh himself had implied that Hillary Clinton had had Vince Foster murdered in her apartment and moved him to Rock Creek Park, or anyway, the whole thing was bizarre. But Robert Fisk found nothing and concluded that there was that it was suicide, as the police had concluded as well. Mm-hmm. And this didn't set well with the movement conservatives. And in the meantime, the statute mandating or permitting the appointment of a special prosecutor had lapsed.
Mm-hmm.
And Clinton was persuaded, since his position was that he had done nothing wrong. Mr. Trump has said the same thing about himself. And so, therefore, he signed into law a new authorization for a special prosecutor. And instead of being appointed by Janet Reno, the attorney general, this appointment became a three-judge panel from the D.C. Circuit Court, which included two movement conservatives themselves. And David Brock outlined their activities, even from the bench before that, in his book, Blinded by the Right. Brock himself had been a right-wing hitman, mm-hmm. and as he conceded with regard to Anita Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, the new prosecutor was Ken Starr, and we know what happened there. But still, there are marked differences. Both Robert Fisk and Ken Starr were Republicans, and they were mm-hmm. investigating a Democratic administration. Mueller is a Republican, appointed by a Republican Department of Justice in a Republican administration.
Yeah.
And yet still there are charges that this is political, this is partisan. But the Democrats don't control anything in Washington at this time, mm-hmm. not the court, not the Senate, not the House, not the executive.
Yeah, Bert, how would you compare the prosecutions of Ken Starr and Robert Mueller so far? What have you noticed?
Well, the thing you notice with Mueller right away, and particularly over the first 17 months, is that he runs about the tightest ship you could possibly run.
Mm-hmm.
There are no leaks. We don't know what Mueller knows. We don't know where he's going. Occasionally, there will be the most vague of hints, but that's about it. Starr, as time went on, became more political and leaked quite a bit as he pursued Clinton through his testimony and kind of, again, this winding road down to Monica Lewinsky.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think there are some differences. And the other thing, that the great difference is that for Mueller, and I think we saw this in the Manafort trial, Mueller has a richness of targets, and they aren't very far from the surface. And so I think that the volume of prosecutions here is very, very different. And the overall impact, I think, will be much greater.
You know, I thought, Max, that a lot of people think that Mueller was just going to look into the possibility of collusion with Russia. But he's not focused just on that now. He's going other places as well. Is that allowable?
Well, it certainly was allowable under the Clinton investigation. It started out as an investigation of a land deal and wound up with oral sex in the Oval Office.
Mm-hmm.
One ironic thing is, if you look at the charges against President Clinton, even if all of them are exactly as his critics had alleged. A relatively minor land deal 20 years previously, sexual irregularities, improprieties, and so forth. Those were certainly scandalous at that time, but they didn't affect national security. They didn't affect performance in office. And as a matter of fact, under today's climate, they would barely rate a mention on the back pages, given everything else we become so unfortunately adjusted to.
And is there anything prohibiting him from going further than Russian collusion?
No.
Okay.
And Steve, I mean,
yeah,
part of that original mandate is that if he uncovers crimes in the midst of what his original investigation, he has the authority to go after that. He did it in one way with Manafort by charging him, mm-hmm. and another way by handing off the Cohen case to the Southern District of New York. Hmm. So, and again, you've got with Mueller and his team of prosecutors, you know, a highly professional group that has dozens and dozens of various complicated cases under their belts.
You know, it seemed like Republicans were beginning this drumbeat a few days ago, maybe even a couple of weeks ago, for Mueller to wrap up his investigation by September. What do the developments with Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort do to that timetable, Max?
Well, the timetable itself was more public relations than anything else. You don't have politicians telling police and investigators
how much time they got,
how much time they have, or what they're supposed to do. And we need to remember that whether the charges are accurate or not, the things that are alleged are terrible threats to our national security and to the basic institutions of this country. They're nothing like the Clinton improprieties.
Mm-hmm. You know, Ken Starr's case against Bill Clinton, Byrd, led to the filing of articles of impeachment against him in the House, but the Senate stopped short of conviction. Is the impeachment of President Trump in the cards here based on what we know today?
With this Congress, absolutely not.
Because it's a Republican Congress.
Right, yeah. Right. I think that if you get past the election into next January, you have a Democratic House, that it certainly becomes more a possibility. I do think that the Democrats, certainly in the campaigns, are extraordinarily wary about even talking about impeachment. They don't want that to be the focus of the campaign. Once you get in, if they do take control of the House, there's certainly going to be pressure. On the other hand, in all likelihood, there will be a Republican Senate, or if not, certainly enough Republicans to block conviction. And I think that that was crucial in the Clinton case, that House members, and this remember, this is the Newt Gingrich Congress post-1994, mm-hmm. highly partisan, they knew that conviction was extraordinarily unlikely, and they pursued it, and not really to their benefit. They lost seats, for example, in the 1998 election. So I think Democratic leaders will be very wary. Democratic rank and file, if they win control, may feel their pressure more.
We're talking about the use of special prosecutors to investigate presidents. If you have a question for our good panel here, 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCUR up to date. You get a sense, Max, that even Republicans now are beginning to acknowledge that the president is in a world of hurt.
Yes. It would be hard not to recognize that. Professor Loomis is absolutely correct. Bill Clinton was impeached, but the Republican Senate did not even get a majority for conviction, and it takes a two-thirds majority in the Senate. They had 50 mm-hmm. votes, and it took 51 to get even a majority, and even that would not have led to removal from office. The Democrats may well take over the House, and impeachment then would certainly be far more likely. Whether or not they would do it, it would be unless there's something so horrendous that Mr. Trump loses support of the Republican Party, which doesn't appear to be in the works.
Yeah.
If they were to impeach, Even if the Democrats controlled the Senate, they wouldn't have two-thirds. It simply is not possible, even if everything worked exactly right for the Democrats, for them to have more than, say, 55 seats.
Yeah. You know, Bird, help me here. There's two tracks that are going on here at the same time. One is impeachment, which is viewed as a highly and intensively political process. The other is the criminal route here. But this idea that the president will one day be indicted, you know, criminally, doesn't appear to be in the cards. Isn't there a policy out there that the Justice Department simply will not indict a sitting president?
That certainly seems to be the practiced rule. You'll see some arguments about that, but lawyers can argue about virtually anything. I think that is the received wisdom. A criminal complaint. I think that where you do get problems with a criminal complaint, if you go down the Manafort line with more money, more Russian connections, even if it wasn't related to the election, you might find things that were problematic. There's a fascinating piece on the front page of the New York Times today about impeachment. And the argument is, and this is an originalist interpretation coming from the framers, that trying to affect the election before you're elected, even with some kind of criminal intent or unethical practices, that in itself was something that the framers talked about as an impeachable offense. And so that's why with Cohen, the key two charges are the campaign finance. On the record, they're kind of small potatoes in some ways. They're obscure in some ways, but if the president was trying to affect the election in illegal ways before the election, I think that there is a case that that rises quickly to some kind of possible impeachable offense. That said, everything we said before holds, it's a Republican House, Republican Senate.
Let's go to some phone calls here. Let's go to Elijah from Overland Park. Elijah, good morning. We're talking about the special prosecutors and the presidents. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me on. I was wondering about Robert Mueller's history of partisanship. I understand he's a Republican prosecuting a Republican president, and he seems to be running a very nonpartisan investigation, but I was just wondering if he had a history that people would be worried about.
What's Robert Mueller's political history?
Professional.
Mm-hmm.
He has not been an active partisan.
Okay. That's what we know.
Yes.
Okay.
Elijah? He's also the FBI director under both Republicans and Democrats.
Right.
I mean, you know, this is a guy, and if you read back into his biography, as a military man, et cetera, this is a guy who has played it straight down the middle for his entire professional career.
Hmm. Let's go to Jay from Independence. Jay, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me on the show. Real quick, we hear recordings and from the president, and he says, I didn't do it, and then I did do it. Now, any of us would not be able to get away with this. It's recorded. It's not someone else saying it. It's recorded, and then we have our public officials who seem to be more concerned about staying in their office than actually doing something with the office to help our citizens.
Max, do you want to comment on that?
There's nothing I can say that would disagree with the caller.
Mm-hmm.
There is a lot of reckless rhetoric or ignorant rhetoric out there. I've heard people say, we need to get rid of Trump now. Don't fool around with impeachment. Go for Amendment 25 procedures. Well, the 25th Amendment would be more difficult to enforce than impeachment. Mm-hmm. You can impeach with a majority of the House and remove with two-thirds of the Senate. A 25th Amendment procedure, if the president objects to being removed, would require two-thirds of the House as well as the Senate. So that doesn't make sense.
Maybe just a final point here, Bird. You know, both Bill Clinton's team and the Trump administration have gone after their prosecutor adversaries with unbridled aggression. Why are these wars waged against federal prosecutors who, after all, they're not elected officials?
Well, I mean, I think it ends up being politics. And certainly, I think the Clintons felt that they had been unfairly attacked in various ways, that they were the victims of an over-aggressive prosecutor. And so they eventually attacked James Carville and others, pretty vigorously. I think it's quite different in 2017, 2018. We're in an era of social media. As Jay points out, we're in an era in which we wake up to find out what the president has tweeted that morning. Mm-hmm. And so much of this now is fought out in the media. And I think that's why the Manafort and Cohen cases were so significant. That it brings us back to something you talked about before, that a lot of Republicans were confronted with real facts, real convictions. And I think, honestly, their silence in the wake of that has spoken volumes.
We're going to have to leave our conversation there. That was the voice of Burdette Loomis from the University of Kansas. Max Skidmore from UMKC also joined us. Thank you both very much. Appreciate
it. Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Coming up, Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list.
People talking about what is and what ain't country. What gives them a right to wear a pair of beat-up boots? Is it the size of your tires and your fires or your wild-ass buddies? Well, give me a minute and let me hit you with some hometown truth. You can be a cowboy on the Texas plain or a plowboy waiting on the rain. We're all a little different, but we're all the same. Everybody doing their own thing. I got my dirt road cred when I was 12 on a no-cab tractor hauling in.
Well, Brian McTavish is here to talk about some cool stuff to do on your weekend, and we're listening to the tuneful Luke Bryan.
Always tuneful.
He'll be in town Sunday night.
Luke Bryan, hit country and then some. He opens his mouth and a number one country hit comes out.
Is that what the deal is?
That's pretty much what the deal is. 7 o'clock Sunday at the Sprint Center. Mm. He's currently wowing arena crowds in straightforward style. You know, he's also an American Idol judge.
Oh, is that right?
Well, that means he's arrived.
Yes.
I mean, if you're an American
is that
Idol.
What it means?
Well, yeah. It means a lot of things. But yeah, it definitely means I don't think he has to worry about the checking account anymore.
I'll wait for the phone call from American Idol to join the judging
and
panel.
And I will. I'll get it right to you when they call me by mistake. Okay. Anyway, this is What Makes You Country. He's on his What Makes You Country tour. He's the Georgia-born singer-songwriter who asks the musical question, does it run in your blood? Did it come from your daddy and your mama? Were you converted by an Alabama song on the radio that feels so right? Well, not quite for me. It was more likely Roger Miller's Trailers for Sale or Rent. How about you?
What
did you like as a kid? What first hooked your ear, whether you were 10 or if it was last week? What's a country song that you kind of dig on?
I did not listen to country when I was a little boy.
I'll bet when you
I just did not.
Yes, you did. Your parents did. So you'd
maybe
hear
Johnny Cash.
Of course, Johnny Cash.
Yeah,
yeah, you walked the line with Johnny. How about Tammy Wynette, Stand By Your Man? Or, hey, we all watch the Beverly Hillbillies, those of us of a certain vintage, and there's that Foggy Mountain Breakdown, Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs, right? I mean, they did the theme. They kind of worked the... So whatever your country flavor is, Brian wants you to fess up to it, and everybody certainly will, standing on their chairs when it's Luke Bryan, 7 o'clock Sunday at the Sprint Center.
My grandpa, he's 95. Keeps on dancing, he's still alive. My grandma, she's 92. She loves to dance and sing some too. I don't know, but I've been told if you keep on dancing, you'll never grow old. Come on, darling, put a pretty dress on. We're gonna go out tonight. Dance, dance, dance.
Okay, let's go dancing. Where are we going dancing?
This is
going
to be great. You can put your pretty dance on. You can put your leotards on. You can just wear your eternal summer shorts.
It's a nice song.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that takes us back to Steve Miller.
Steve Miller Band,
Well, there's a rock song for everything. Even if rock music isn't at the fore during KC Dance Day, you get your free dance lessons, you get your free dance performances, and you get a free open rehearsal by the Kansas City Ballet. This is the 8th annual Kansas City Ballet, KC Dance Day. Where else? But at the Todd Bolander Center for Dance and Creativity, right downtown in the virtual home, or the real home for that matter, of the Kansas City Ballet. It all happens at the Bolander Center from 9 to 6 on Saturday. It's all free, except, and this is pretty cheap, the most it's going to cost you is $6 for the eat-in lunch.
Oh.
And they've got a mighty fine, even a veggie thing to do. Whether you're healthy or not, you're going to move them feet, are you not, at KC Dance Day all day Saturday at the Todd Bolander Center.
And be sure to see Brian. 6 honest things to do in Kansas City this weekend. You'll find it at kcur.org. Let's move on and talk about David Cross, a stand-up comedian.
Yeah. Now, David Cross, are you a fan of Arrested Development? I can say that by any chance. Well, that's the great television show that was on for several years,
right.
And I'm sure many listeners are fans of it. And David Cross played the more or less insane. What was his name? Dr. Tobias Funk.
Mm.
He was a bad actor who thought he was a good actor.
Right.
And there was a famous episode or two where he actually impersonates a blue man, or thinks he's a blue man, or thinks he's in the group. In any event, he also is responsible for Mr. Show, which was a very, 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 one more very funny sketch comedy show on TV. Anyway, he is in town doing his stand-up thing at 8 o'clock Saturday at the Arvis Bank Theater at the Midland. Okay, now, what do you think he thinks about empathy? Let's hear what David Cross, what are his thoughts on feeling the feelings of others?
Let's be honest, that's what makes America weak, is empathy. When we care about those less fortunate than ourselves, that's what's bringing us down. It's that kind of altruistic attitude that weakens us as a nation. Sure. Ask Ayn Rand. She'll tell you. Ask Ayn Rand. I believe you can still find her ghost haunting the same public housing she died in while on Social Security and Medicare.
Okay.
Public housing on Social Security
He's
and Medicare.
He's making his point.
He's making his point. We probably don't need to make it anymore him.
Yeah.
Anyway, David Cross will tell you how he really feels. He's actually one of the top 100 stand-up comedians of all time, as decided somehow or another by Comedy Central. And, you know, Rodin's the thinker. You know how you sit there and you kind of, you know, rub your chin like Rodin's the thinker? That's what you're going to do if you're in the audience for the show, because he really wants to put on your thinking cap for you. David Cross, Saturday at Arvis Bank Theater at the Midland.
I recognize that voice, that saxophone voice.
It is
anywhere.
A voice.
It is a voice.
It's more of a voice than a real voice.
The great
it's
Charlie Parker.
The great, the everlasting.
Our
Charlie Parker. Kansas City's very own. Charlie Parker Celebration Concert will happen 8 o'clock Saturday night at the Gem Theater. Your host with the most will be Kansas City's own Ronald McFadden. Word on the street is that Kansas City's own Bobby Watson will attend.
Yes, he will.
And three-time Grammy winner, also a sax man, T-Von Pennicott.
Yes.
So that's Saturday night, but there's a big buildup. You know, we're celebrating Charlie Parker this time of year. So if you want to go out and see Lonnie McFadden perform in all the ways he can and will at 7 o'clock tonight at Chaz on the Plaza, or maybe also tonight at the Ship at 8:30, check out Dominique Sanders, Ernest Melton, Ryan Lee, and the aforementioned T-Von Pennicott. And there's one more little plug I want to get in here. Oh, Kansas City Jazz History Tour, 10 o'clock, 18th and Vine. Be there. All in the name of Charlie Parker.
Such a feeling's coming over me. There is wonder in most. lost everything.
Boy, this group has got a lot of staying power. Man, they're still on the scene.
Carpenters.
Yeah.
The most beautiful pop alto ever. That's Karen Carpenter. No longer with us, sadly. The music remains. Go check out Top of the World, the Carpenters tribute. The music, the ever-wonderful music of the Carpenters, 7:30 tonight and Friday, 2 and 7:30 Saturday, and 2 Sunday at the Chestnut Fine Arts Center. Several very talented local singers and players will share the beauty of the Carpenters.
And that's Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Tomorrow on the show, there's lots to see in the theaters right now. We'll run it all down, and we'll review Black Klansman, the flick co-written by the University of Kansas professor Kevin Wilmot. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Kathleen Pointer. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.